Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm Archit Guha, a host on the New Books in South Asia channel in the New Books Network. And today we have with us Professor Kasia Paprocki, who is here to discuss her book, Threatening Dystopias, The Global Politics of Climate Change Adaptation in Bangladesh, published by Cornell University Press in 2021. Kasia is an associate professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Her work draws on and contributes to the political ecology of development and agrarian change with a focus on South Asia and specifically Bangladesh, where she has worked and conducted research for over 15 years. Welcome, Kasia, and thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here for this discussion with you.
Yeah, and this book is so amazingly compelling. And I think the story behind your journey to writing the book will obviously be very fascinating to listeners as well. So if we can start with your journey to, you know, researching this book and the PhD, because this is your first book as well. So how did it all come about? You also have your journey as a development practitioner working with an organization that is closely kind of centered in the book. So if you can speak to all of that, that would be great. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, I'm very happy to. Thanks for that question. Like you said, I've been working in Bangladesh for about 15 years, and I had originally been doing some research as an undergraduate student on microcredit. And while I was doing that, I met and had the opportunity to start working with this organization called Nidra Akori, which means we do it ourselves in Bengali. And Nidra Akori is technically an NGO, but it's an NGO that organizes, does community organizing for a network of autonomous organizations of landless peasants all over Bangladesh. I hadn't been to on the sort of southern edge of the country, bordering the Bay of Bengal. And it was really the focus of their work at that point. And they were doing a lot of mobilization, but they were not, they hadn't done a lot of research on it. And so they said, if you could do research on commercial shrimp production, that would be something that we could really use. So I went to Khulna, which is a sort of state in southwestern Bangladesh, with a movement organizer, and they sort of introduced me to several communities that had been working against aquaculture with varying degrees of success. And along with a colleague of mine, anthropologist Jason Kahns, who's now at the University of Texas at Austin, we did a participatory study of sort of the political economy of shrimp cultivation with movement members there. And that was a really important time for me to sort of learn about what was going on from the perspective of communities and activists, and to understand kind of the stakes of what shrimp aquaculture was doing to these communities. And so, I mean, basically shrimp started in this region through really rampant land grabbing, which was often very violent and illegal. And it has had these really devastating ecological impacts, not to mention these really devastating social impacts. And, you know, from sort of seeing what was happening in these communities, the question I kept coming back to is, why are these development agencies continuing to promote shrimp aquaculture if it is obviously so violent and having such negative impacts and there's so much resistance from these communities? So I started going on my own to talk to development agencies and their offices in Dhaka and in Khulna, the sort of capital city of the district, and just asking people, like, why are you still, you know, what's the logic behind promoting shrimp aquaculture? Because it's getting investment from all the major aid agencies, the World Bank, USAID. And the thing that I kept hearing them say is, well, whatever happened in the past, shrimp is the only option for this region because of climate change, because the impacts of climate change and sea level rise are going to make agriculture in this region completely unviable. And, you know, whatever we think about shrimp, it's the only option for people producing in this region sort of going forward. So that was sort of where the idea of climate change came from in the project. And I got really sort of stuck into unraveling what is this science? What's the logic of the sort of unviability of agriculture in this region? How do development agencies and natural scientists see this process of climate change impacting the region? And is this true that, you know, shrimp aquaculture is the only viable production option for the region? And also I had the opportunity to do some archival research to understand, okay, what's the history of this way of seeing the region, and how do the sort of historical dynamics of development also shape these dynamics? So that, yeah, that's sort of the long version of how I came to the project. And I guess I'll conclude that by saying that I think that this sort of backdoor route into studying climate change and adaptation to climate change from the perspective of agrarian political economy, instead of like directly first deciding I wanted to look at climate change and then pursuing a project from that perspective, I think that that orientation really shaped the way not only that I approached the project, but the kind of questions I asked, the conclusions that I drew for sure, and I think made for a much richer study of how we understand the context of climate change and climate response in Bangladesh and South Asia.
It's wonderful, Kasia. Thanks so much. And it was great to learn about your journey, especially with Nijera Kori. I'd like for you to speak a little bit more about that, because that sounds like a crucial piece of this in terms of, you know, how you situated yourself disciplinarily in, I believe, development sociology, and then kind of your approach to these questions. How did that come out of your interaction with you know, Nijera Kori as a nonprofit organization, as an NGO actor, mm-hmm. in this space? Yeah,
that's a great question. You know, at first I thought that I wanted to study the movement itself, Nijera Kori, which I'll say is technically an NGO, but because it's an NGO that sort of organizes autonomous groups, it is essentially a movement, a network of movements, if you will. And you know, when I was thinking about what would it mean to study the movement and sort of engaging with, like, what, you know, what's the work of social movement studies and what does it mean to contribute to a movement by studying it? I didn't feel like I could, I didn't feel like I could contribute to the movement itself by studying it and sort of interrogating it. Not that I'm not open to sort of questioning their claims or the way that they do their work or the kind of positions that they take on different subjects, but I was interested in development. I knew that I didn't want to be like a mainstream development practitioner. And I knew that also I, because of the sort of autonomy of the movement, I could not contribute to it by being part of it. And so I saw becoming an academic as an opportunity to kind of work alongside a movement to learn things that they couldn't necessarily learn and to sort of conduct research that might help to substantiate claims that they were trying to make in sort of public policy debates and sort of helping to authorize their own kinds of campaigns. And so that's why I asked them, like, what is it that you want me to study that matters to you? And as I was, you know, looking at these ideas about shrimp aquaculture as a climate change adaptation strategy, I realized that there was a lot of work I could do as far as, you know, what we call studying up, like, you know, to get into the World Bank headquarters in Dhaka, you go through multiple gates of security officers. And, you know, when I'm in Bangladesh, when I'm in Dhaka, I usually wear a sari, but, you know, when I go into the World Bank headquarters in Dhaka, I'm wearing a blazer and sort of Western dress clothes. And that means that, you know, those spaces, embassy spaces, conferences in Dhaka with, you know, development practitioners and government officials, those are spaces that I could access that movement members couldn't access. And I felt that I could contribute to them by learning things that they couldn't necessarily learn. And also it means that I can sort of bring their perspectives into debates about the future of Bangladesh that are happening away from the communities that are being impacted by those debates and decisions. And that involves really reflexive research practices. It involves really careful attention to ideas about objectivity and who has the right to frame these kinds of debates. My own role as sort of a white person from the global north. So those are the kinds of questions that I spend a lot of time thinking about. What's my role in relation to this movement? But I think that because I've been able to learn so much from them, I've let them, I've really solicited their sort of advice and input on what their needs are and how I can be most helpful. I think I've gained their trust, and that has meant a lot for my own career as a researcher. And I like to think that in some ways it's allowed me to give back to them as well.
Thanks, Kasia. That was, you know, great to kind of get a sense of in terms of your journey, especially with navigating these sorts of different spaces between what was going on in the movement, you know, in Nijarakuri and these spaces that they had to kind of negotiate. And in some senses, what you're saying is that you were an intermediary. One of the most powerful things about your book is also how you're, you know, it is a story about Bangladesh, but you're also traveling through all of these spaces in telling the story about, you know, about climate change, about Khulna and Khulna Nihat. How did that process, in terms of your method, develop? because I found that really, really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I would love to be, I was talking to a group of PhD students recently, and they asked me a similar question about sort of how I developed the methodology for the study that became the book. And I wish I could say that it happened through like a ton of foresight and really careful planning. But it sort of unfolded naturally, to be honest with you. I knew that I was going to spend time in villages in Khulna, with farmers and day laborers. And then I sort of slowly realized that I was going to need to do more research about these development projects and sort of adaptation planning processes in Khulna City and then in Dhaka, the capital. And increasingly, I had to just sort of expand the scope and the number of sites in order to understand those dynamics. So, you know, I wasn't finding all of the day laborers who I anticipated wanting to interview because many of them had already left. And so I said, okay, where have they gone? Well, most of them have gone to Kolkata. Okay, give me their phone numbers and I'll go to Kolkata and I'll track them down. And so I emailed a lot of migrants in Kolkata in order to understand just what the, you know, not just the migration process, but what was happening in the villages that I wanted to understand. The development agencies, you know, their presence is much bigger in Dhaka than it is in Khulna in the sites that they are planning. And so in order to understand their work, you know, I had to spend a lot of time in office buildings and embassies and sort of conference rooms in Dhaka in order to see what was happening there. And from there, I realized, you know, the story of like how the future of Bangladesh is being imagined and planned is happening pretty far beyond Bangladesh even, you know? So there are conferences in Rotterdam or in Kuala Lumpur or in Paris where people are talking about the possibilities for development and adaptation in Bangladesh. And the decisions that are being made in those spaces are really important to what is happening there. And so I had to travel to those sites as well in order to sort of untangle these processes. And I think that the result of doing, of it becoming this really kind of multi-sided ethnography was that I came to understand Bangladesh not as a sort of a unique site in this sort of global, you know, unfolding of ideas about climate change adaptation, but as really kind of a key node in a global political economy of new imaginaries of what the future will look like in the time of climate change. And so I see Bangladesh as a very important site in those debates, and one which we can look at in order to understand what these politics will look like in a lot of different places, sort of now and in the future.
So that brings me to the question about how you've, you know, in the book, you've argued for this almost a continuum with development and adaptation as regimes, right? And I think it would be wonderful to kind of unpack that a little bit more in terms of the history of Bangladesh as well. In your journey as well, you mentioned, you know, your first kind of engagement with Bangladesh through microcredit. That was, if we think about Bangladesh a decade or, you know, two decades ago, that was the story about Bangladesh. And now it's shifted to climate change and, you know, the story about its increased vulnerability or its so I wonder if, you know, this continuum, if we can track both through a longer history of colonial and post-colonial dispossession, which you do, and accumulation processes, but also how development is very much tied to the history of independent Bangladesh and its story of being this sort of quote unquote aid lab, right?
Yeah, exactly. Such a good question. So I, trying to understand this question analytically about the relationship between adaptation and development in Bangladesh has been really difficult and fraught, because on the one hand, I think that and I heard from a lot of the people that I interviewed in Bangladesh that climate change adaptation is just a new word for what a lot of, agencies have been trying to do in the name, of development for a really long time in Bangladesh. And on the other hand, I heard a lot of stories about how adaptation is a real kind of break from the past and allows for new kinds of really unprecedented interventions. And so, the question is this new? Are these politics that we're seeing new for Bangladesh? Is a complex one, and I think it is both. I think that the sort of discourses of unprecedented crisis that allows for really new and much more kind of invasive imaginaries of rethinking and re-engineering this entire region. I think that, discourses of crisis about climate change do allow for that kind of newness. On the other hand, I think that we need to understand these discourses and practices and plans really, really firmly within this longer history of development and intervention in the region. And we can only understand it in some sense through its relationship with this longer history. And so, Bangladesh, since it became independent, has been seen as a kind of laboratory for experimenting with new visions in development. And so Naomi Hossein talks about this in her book, The Aid Lab, which is just a really brilliant study of the history of development in Bangladesh. But there are all of these different examples of kind of experimenting with Bangladesh as this aid and development laboratory. So microcredit was sort of the earlier iteration, like Bangladesh is the place where microcredit happens, and microcredit, at that time in the 90s and early 2000s was kind of the new vision for global development. But even before that, Bangladesh was also a laboratory for sort of population control measures and for a lot of other really experimental kinds of development practice that have had really disastrous consequences for Bangladesh. And this idea of it being a kind of development laboratory was always contingent on the sort of related idea of it being this kind of dystopic space that had no hope or future. And so, Henry Kissinger famously called Bangladesh a basket case. And the idea was that Bangladeshis are not capable of self-determination in planning for their development or their future because it is such a disastrous basket case. And therefore, it's available for experimentation with all different kinds of development interventions. And this idea of Bangladesh as this kind of dystopic basket case, I found as I sort of tiptoed into the archive. I mean, I'm not trained as a historian, but I think that doing research in archives is just like so magical. And I was just like shocked and thrilled to find these historical patterns coming so clearly out of the archives about how colonial administrators also saw Bangladesh as this really dystopic space. And, you know, it's interesting, a lot of that was related to like Bangladesh and the Sundarbans in particular, which is sort of what made up historically this region of Khulna where I've been doing ethnographic research. The Sundarbans were the primary shipping route to Kolkata when Kolkata was the capital of the Raj. And the Sundarbans are always shifting. The waterways are shifting, the land is shifting, the people are moving. And so it really sort of defied this colonial control. And in a very like material practical sense, it made it really difficult for the British to get their ships through. And so you see all of these like crazy stories and narratives and sort of fictitious accounts of the Sundarbans as this terrible space full of tigers and disease that was, you know, in need of control by British administrators. So there were all sorts of really exceptional plans for controlling the landscape through both kind of new technologies in engineering physical embankments, and also in engineering very special land control systems that would facilitate sort of taking control over this region. And so these ideas, and also the physical interventions that they began implementing during the colonial period, provide a really, really important foundation for the way that climate change is impacting the region today, the way that people are able to respond to climate and other kinds of ecological change. And I think that, you know, the sort of the lesson here is that trying to understand climate change without a clear understanding of this colonial history makes it impossible for us to understand like how we got where we are today and the kind of challenges that are confronted by this or indeed any other post-colonial region.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, you in the book have this ethnographic vignette of a Jomindari body, right? Landlord's house and their sort of stake in controlling Khulna, and I thought that was really powerful to kind of see how this history, although you know we've kind of gone through this discourse of you know abolition, is still persists in various ways and affects landholding patterns and labor as well, right? And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit more in terms of you know the way you saw the you know the what was going on in terms of the realities of Khulna and Kolanihat today being shaped by these very material processes that created certain hierarchies and allowed for particular processes of accumulation and dispossession, right?
You know, the way that shrimp aquaculture and particularly the sort of processes through which it has taken over from the kind of agrarian political economy of rice cultivation, the way that it has sort of worked its way into the fabric of agrarian life is through both sort of very long historical patterns of labor exploitation and class inequality in the region, but also through sort of new predatory capital that is coming into the region. And understanding those two things together and the way that they shape the political economy of shrimp aquaculture, and also the way that they shape sort of the response to climate change, I think really helps to get a more nuanced understanding of what's happening there today. So development agencies love to say that people have a choice about whether or not to farm shrimp or rice, and that we can see that they are choosing shrimp because so many villages have been taken over by shrimp. And when you sort of dig into what's happening, how people make these decisions, and the sort of material process of trying to cultivate either shrimp or rice, you find that actually these sort of regimes of labor and landholding really question that idea that people cultivate whatever it is that they want to cultivate. So, you know, there still are these very large landholders in the region, some of whom have held a lot of land historically, and some of whom have grabbed a lot of land coming from outside that, you know, they sort of gained control over in different kinds of sort of predatory ways. And so this one Jomidar Bari in one of the villages where I was working was a really interesting case, because they had started cultivating shrimp in the 80s when the shrimp boom had started, and they basically, the shrimp that was being cultivated on their land was being cultivated by these sort of outside businessmen who they didn't think were giving them as much money as they deserved. And this entire village in Polder 23, where they lived, had been resisting shrimp, wanting to go back to rice, and really struggling to do it. And at some point, the sort of descendants of these Jomidars, who you know, clearly still had a lot of resources because they lived in this very large estate, but also you know, they had gone to India, and then at some point they had come back to Bangladesh, and their fortunes had deteriorated, obviously, quite a bit. But they still had a lot of power locally. And so even though, you know, for a decade or more, there were all these smallholders who had been trying to get control of their land back, these descendants had gone to the police station, and they had sort of had access to the documents, and they had had enough clout with the local police to demand that they get control over their land again. And that was the beginning of a movement for, you know, many different smallholders to be able to say, okay, we should be able to access our lands, and we do want to control our land again, which had been sort of entirely taken over by these land grabbers. So it was interesting to know that, but then they decided, we're going to keep cultivating shrimp mostly, but we're going to have a couple sort of landless people, day laborers, cultivate rice just in the area around our Bari. The rest of the majority of the land in the village continued to be controlled by this guy who had come from Khulna, was not a local resident, had a lot of money from outside, and he had built his own sluice gate. So there are like government sluice gates in every sort of hydrological unit in the region. But then he sort of broke the embankment, built his own sluice gate. And that meant that he made all the decisions about whether to flood not only his own land, but the land of basically everyone else in the village. And so there was no autonomy in making a decision about whether or not the land was going to be flooded for shrimp. So if you wanted to grow rice, you didn't have the ability to make that decision, because this guy was making the decision for everyone that like this land is going to be flooded with salt water from the river and we are going to cultivate shrimp. And whether or not it works for you, that is what we're going to be doing. And so I see these two figures of, you know, the descendants living in the Jomidar Bari and Wakil, who had his own sluice gate, as these two figures of different kinds of elite capital that were making decisions for the entire village about how to cultivate, and that were shaped by these like both longer historic and also contemporary patterns of land holding and land control that need to be understood sort of in concert with one another.
Mm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, no, and I think that's also really important to understanding the story of the shift from rice to shrimp aquaculture, right? Rice cultivation so if you could give us a sense of how that actually happened, because in part that's a story about what is going on the ground, you know, in these spaces like Boulder 23, but it's also you know, being constructed in different ways outside. So this, you know, gets us to also the, you know, the way that you framed your entire narrative about, you know, the question of adaptation being one that functions on these two scales of imagining and then experimenting, right? Which we've discussed a little bit about. But if you could talk about that in the context of the shift from rice to shrimp, that would be great.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting about studying the use of shrimp aquaculture as a climate change adaptation strategy is that the shift to shrimp from rice started a long time before adaptation was ever on the agenda. And so in the 1980s, development agencies started really actively promoting a shift from rice to shrimp through structural adjustment programs and sort of interventions and plans and projects for export-led growth in Bangladesh. Shrimp was seen as sort of the next big export commodity for Bangladesh. And today it is the second largest export after garments from Bangladesh. And there's a lot of resistance to this. So I worked in three what are called polders, which is sort of islands surrounded by these protective dikes. And one of the polders, Polder 22, has historically resisted shrimp and never farmed shrimp and continues to farm rice today. Polder 23 transitioned to shrimp and has now is basically entirely a shrimp growing region. And Polder 29 has sort of shifted back to rice from shrimp, which I'll talk about in a second. So, in Polder 22, there was a very strong movement that resisted shrimp, and the movement was galvanized really by the martyrdom of one movement leader who was murdered by land grabbers who wanted to bring shrimp into the village. And so, this woman, her name is Kurunamoyi Sardar. And throughout the entire region, throughout Khulna, even in villages where nobody's heard of Nijara Kori, people talk about the Kurunamoyi Andolon, the Kurunamoyi movement. And so and they have a big festival every year to sort of commemorate and celebrate the movement and Kurunamoyi. And, that's been really important to sort of galvanizing support for maintaining agricultural production in Polder 22. In Polder 23, they didn't have a strong movement at the beginning. The region was taken over by shrimp aquaculturalists, and they have not been able to return to rice from shrimp. In Polder 29, there's a movement that is sort of growing in strength that has started in a couple villages and is kind of expanding over the last, I'd say maybe 10 years, to regain control of the land and to shift from shrimp back to rice. And what is really, really important about that movement in Polder 29 in particular is that the development agencies who continue to promote shrimp in these areas where it is already being cultivated and sort of in areas where they would like to see it transitioned to, they say rice agriculture is not viable in the areas that have been cultivating shrimp, and that sea level rise makes rice growing essentially impossible. And so this is a particular imaginary of the region that says, the region is going to be not only sort of ecologically devastated by shrimp, which is, shrimp requires salt water to grow. And so that means that basically after you flood the land, then nothing else can grow. And in Polder 23, in the villages where I worked, like all the trees died, people can't grow home gardens. And, because there also isn't a lot of grass, they don't have animals to graze, they can't collect firewood and things like that. So it has all these cascading, really devastating ecological impacts. And the imaginary of this kind of devastated ecological space is we have to give it up and nothing else is possible. And so it's okay to sort of experiment with, this kind of ecological devastation because there's no hope for this region. Well, the possibility of return is made evident by the fact that there are these villages in Polder 29 and a few others in the region that have been able to successfully return. It took them a long time. It was very painful because you have to flood, depending on how long shrimp has been cultivated, the salt needs to be essentially like leached from the soil through many, many monsoons in order to regain the fertility of the soil to start cultivating rice again. And so that was like a long and difficult period for the people in this village where I worked in Polder 29 to sort of, stave off the sort of pressure to return to shrimp. And they actually had to have the movement in Polder 29 had to have like a nightly watch group where they would sort of stand at the sluice gate overnight with lattes, with clubs, to prevent anyone from coming and opening the sluice gate and flooding their land again at night. And so this is, difficult work, and it's work that you only can or will do if you really, really believe in an agrarian future for your community. And the fact that they did and that they put in all this work means that you know, after about 7 years of this sort of flushing of the salt through the monsoon and not cultivating shrimp, that this community in Polder 29 was not able to return to rice cultivation, but all of the people who had been forced to leave during the time when they were cultivating shrimp, all of these landless laborers were able to return to participate again in agricultural production. And so these, you know, three different sites really kind of demonstrate what these competing visions of the future look like in the context of shrimp and also climate change.
Thanks for that. That really, you know, brings to bear and illustrates that, you know, that there are these alternatives to the dystopic that is being constructed, right? But it'd also be great to learn more about how these dystopias essentially are being made possible through particularly, you know, climate science and scientific knowledge production in concert with, you know, development agencies and NGOs, like you mentioned in the book. So what kind of knowledge production does that entail, and what disjunctures does it create between lived realities and, development planning?
Yeah. So, I mean, this question of whether or not agriculture is viable was one that I realized was framed as kind of an objective scientific fact, and one which had sort of an unclear basis to me. And so I spent a lot of time interviewing the scientists who are, there's just a ton of science happening, studies of the physical geography of the region and what is happening in the context of climate change. And so, you know, I decided I want to spend time interviewing these scientists and understanding what they know and what they don't know about the region and sort of how they know what they know, how they do this work, and what that means for how planning and policy happen and how they're sort of informed by this science. And I'd say I found two things about this. The one thing is that there's a lot of uncertainty about what is happening in the region. And a lot of natural scientists will say, we really don't know how to attribute the impacts of climate change to the kind of processes that we're looking at. We can do some untangling of climate impacts from other impacts. And to the extent that we can do that, we believe that climate change is not the primary driver of ecological change in the region. But the other thing I found is also that within this politics of uncertainty about what is happening, the sort of preconceptions about the region and its kind of dystopic future that I've just been discussing, which, you know, sort of come in from all sorts of different discursive angles. You know, there's like this long colonial history, there's the New York Times saying this is a region without a future. There are, you know, Bangladeshi sort of activists and government agencies themselves saying, you know, this is a real threat that needs to be addressed, whether or not there's a future for the region. And so all of this kind of informs the way that natural scientists do their work. And they often approach the region as essentially already doomed. And so the kind of language of the way that people think about the future of coastal Bangladesh is shaped by their own understandings of it being, first of all, of it being a region without a desirable agrarian future, and also their own understandings of agrarian futures not being desirable. And so I found that the assumptions about the lack of desirable agrarian futures from scientists really informed the way that they approached their questions and shaped their sort of analyses of what was happening in a lot of different ways. I think that the result of that is sort of two specific conclusions. One is that there are some things that we know and there are some things that we don't know about what is happening, but that gap around like what we know and we don't know is mobilized in very particular ways by development practitioners to pursue different kinds of futures. And so, you know, what we don't know about the possibility for agrarian futures is used by development agencies to say, we don't know if this is desirable, so we're not going to invest in it. But, you know, we do think that shrimp is desirable for the future, and therefore we are going to invest in it. It means that we don't know a lot about things like climate migration. And so, you know, there's so much investment in the study of climate change in Bangladesh that there is a lot more money going into the study of climate migration than there is going into the study of migration in general. And that means that these kind of assumptions about like the fact that this is going to happen and is going to have these particular kinds of effects really shapes what we know about, you know, how many people are moving, why they're going to move, and why they're moving right now. It also shapes the planning that's happening for the physical landscape. And so there is a lot of money that is supporting like foreign engineers to plan new major infrastructural investments in all over Bangladesh, but especially across the coastal region. And essentially none of that money is going into projects where Bangladeshi engineers are kind of the PIs or the leaders of projects to sort of say, this is how we want to do this work, and this is the approach that we're going to take. There are a lot of really great Bangladeshi engineers and planners, but they are rarely given the opportunity to sort of lead this work. And that means that we have a limited understanding of the kinds of paradigms and strategies that there could be for mitigating the impacts of climate change. There's a lot of money going into building these huge, very kind of charismatic infrastructural investments in embankments and, you know, major concrete constructions. There is very little investment in studying the potential of like a sort of variety of different, more indigenous strategies for managing water and sediment that a lot of local people will discuss as like potential alternatives to those major infrastructural investments. And so I think there's a lot we know, there's a lot we don't know, and the way that we're responding to what we know and don't know is in turn shaping the physical landscape itself.
Yeah, as someone interested in the politics of uncertainty myself, I found that really something important to think with in terms of the way that the obfuscation of knowledge works, right? And almost like willful ignorance in some ways. But you've also mentioned, you know, that there are these alternative visions that are being laid out by the community. So if you could speak to that a little bit more in terms of what you encountered at you know, for example, COP23 in Bonn, and now we're at COP27, versus what's going on in terms of these communities responding to, you know, these changes, and also, you know, if in terms of your work as well, what has shifted after you finished field work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, yeah, if I can take a moment just to sort of speculate on COP27, which is, you know, right now we're right in the middle of it. To be honest with you, I'm not terribly hopeful about the politics of these sort of international agreements. However, I do not think that is where we should find our hope about the future under climate change, because the kinds of politics that I saw of climate change adaptation in Bangladesh suggest that agreements about how to deal with and pursue the future under climate change that take place exclusively through states, the best case scenario is pretty bad. And it looks a lot like the kinds of things that I'm talking about in Bangladesh, like lots and lots of money going into projects planned by development agencies that have this history that is, you know, very unequal and is not suggestive of a sort of radical potential for a liberatory future. So I think that where we can find more hope is in the visions of sort of community groups and activists who are attentive to these longer histories and who see their own political struggles as being embedded in broader stakes of sort of broader political movements for climate justice. So, you know, Nidra Khoury does not speak the language of climate change. They're sort of increasingly starting to think about it, but they don't organize around climate justice. They do organize for a lot of other kinds of justice. They organize for agrarian justice. They organize to sort of demand the delivery of the rights to which they have entitlements from the state. They organize for gender-based justice and against communal violence in their communities, and for sort of class justice, for the rights of landless peoples to access common lands, which is sort of enshrined in the Bangladeshi constitution. So there are all of these campaigns for justice that they pursue in communities all over Bangladesh. And I think that what my book shows is that we can only understand climate justice happening through these kinds of political movements for justice embedded in specific communities. And, you know, that's not something that's going to be achieved through the COP system. And so the COP system, you know, has a role to play in sort of pushing to mitigate emissions and sort of create a transition in you know, our energy systems and our economic systems, but it is not where the sort of struggles for justice in our specific communities are happening today. And I think that the strategies that Nidra Khoury is employing in agrarian communities in Bangladesh are much more hopeful as far as pursuing those alternative visions of more equitable futures.
Thanks, Kasia. I think that really is, you know, a note for hope, but it's also one that allows us to contextualize how climate change works as this master narrative, right? And sometimes, you know, climate change, working outside of that narrative doesn't necessarily equate to climate change denialism, especially in spaces that have longer histories of environmental change and ecological instabilities that speak to what is going on in the contemporary moment as well. So I think that's really something that all of us must kind of contend with in our own research. And so thanks so much. But I won't let you go before kind of getting you to speak a little bit more about what you're working on right now and what we can possibly hope to read of your work in the future.
Yeah, thank you. So my sort of next project, I'd say, sort of grows out of this this work, because I'm focused on sort of the politics of expertise in climate change adaptation, and also where it intersects with colonial histories and decolonial movements for the future that respond to climate change. So I'm planning to do some ethnographic work with more sort of global experts who are kind of peddling their expertise on climate change in Bangladesh and elsewhere around the world, and also collaborating with a historian, Debjani Bhattacharya, who works on sort of colonial histories of climate and climate response in South Asia, to think about what decolonizing the future under climate change will look like. So that's my future work in a nutshell. I wish that I had more to say about it, but it's work that I'm really excited about, and I think is really informed by the things that I think are most pressing coming out of this book project.
Now that sounds incredibly exciting, and I'm sure we'll all, as we've learned from Settling Dystopias, we'll learn a lot from that work. And it also sounds very exciting because you're doing this sort of collaborative work, which allows us to kind of see different perspectives on the same issue. So thanks so much, Kasia, for joining us and sharing so generously of your time. I certainly learned
a lot. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, and I hope our listeners do as well.
Great, thanks. This has been a real pleasure. I appreciate all of your great questions.
Likewise.